All right, the next matter we'll take up is Teresa DeYoung against the Commonwealth. I'm sorry, yes, you may be seated. Mr. Powers and Mr. Chandoval. Mr. Powers, I noticed you came in late. If you haven't had occasion to, please remember to sign in before you leave.
I was able to do that, Your Honor, during the recess, so.
Thank you.
Thank you for the reminder, but I believe my name is attached to this case.
All right. Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve about 5 or 6 minutes for rebuttal.
5 or 6?
6 minutes.
All right.
I think would be plenty of time for this one.
We'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready, then.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I'm here representing Ms. Young, who was convicted of obtaining money by false pretenses and making a false statement on the application for Medicaid, which is basically the state version of the federal Medicaid fraud type of situation. She was an aide at a home health care facility, and the gist of the evidence is that she falsified numerous timesheets that were then submitted to the payroll and timekeeping people at the business, and they are then processed and sent
electronically. Mr. Powers, we're familiar with the facts. Let me kind of cut to the chase here. If I understand your assignment of error correctly, basically your suggestion is that the error here is the court not enforcing its sequestration order, correct?
Yes.
The statute, of course, 192.265 requires, upon request or sua sponte by the court, that witnesses in cases be separated or excluded from the court when they're not testifying. It seems to me that actually was done here. The issue, I guess, is whether the court's order covers the situation that we do have here, where during a recess, the witnesses examined the same exhibit simultaneously, although I'm not sure if there's any evidence they discussed it among themselves, but they certainly were together in examining the exhibit. The trial court interpreting its own order suggested it was not a violation. Where does that leave us?
The trial court does say that they didn't think that was a problem, and the reason the trial court says that, if you look in the transcript, I believe the court says this in the appendix on page 151 in the appendix, and the court says this conversation between Ms. Elliott, who is the, there are two Elliots, this is Christine Elliott, the one we're talking about, and Melson, occurs before Melson testified. And so he says because of that, because it was before that, it's not a testimonial, so there's no real problem with the sequestration of witnesses. That's what the court says. The point is that Ms. Elliott, Christine Elliott, says just immediately prior to that, that I was talking with, this is the page before, I was talking with Ms. Nelson about that spreadsheet or this CHIRPS thing, and you were doing this when we took the break to come back at about 2:15, and this is clearly after Nelson has testified, and she says, yes, ma'am, this is on an examination as to whether or not she should even testify. And she says, I had this conversation during the break. We come back at 2:15, and then I'm called as a witness. It's clearly her understanding that she had the conversation after Nelson testified.
Well, let me stop you, Mr. Power, because it seems to me what the court said was step out of the courtroom and don't discuss the case, basically. The evidence is, as I, in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, is that they were out of the courtroom, and the Commonwealth attorney presented them with an exhibit during a recess saying, I'm going to be asking you about this exhibit, or words to that effect, please look this over, and the two witnesses did so. And there's no indication in the record that the Commonwealth attorney did anything other than that, or that the witnesses did anything other than that. Now, if that's the case, why is the circuit court in error in concluding that its own order was not breached?
I believe that the reason for that, Your Honor, is that factually what happened is, once again recorded on page 149, when Mr. Toker from the Attorney General's office says in explanation as to this conference that these two witnesses are having, this is what he says. He says, I asked Ms. Melson to just make sure that Ms. Elliott was familiar with the CHRP, that's this spreadsheet, the claims data sheet, which has been referenced in Ms. Melson's testimony. But at that point, the document hadn't been introduced. So he thinks because the document hasn't been introduced, it's not a problem. But he has directed a witness who has already testified to speak to another witness and ask a question that he himself is forbidden to do. He has suborned their violation of the order because he asked a witness to do. She's his proxy. He has asked Melson to do something that he clearly cannot do himself.
Counsel, if
he had just given him a paper.
You're not indicating that there's any error in reference to the Attorney General's action, are you? Because I don't see where you've argued that below or where counsel below had argued that.
Counsel below did not argue that. He clearly was wrong to do that.
I'm not making a comment
and
on
because
that. I'm
of,
asking
because,
about the error.
Because,
that's not before us.
No, that's not a sign. But his asking Melson to do what he is prohibited to do is what leads to the violation. They then discuss something which they would never have done. Clearly, and these are two women that basically don't even know each other, probably couldn't have recognized each other. They work in totally different departments. But when Toker asks Melson to do what he cannot do, he sets into effect this chain of events that causes the court completely to get, I think, factually wrong. Now, the Commonwealth disagrees with me. The Attorney General disagrees with me on the timing of all of these. But looking at the record, it's clearly confusing. But I think from Elliott's testimony, she had this discussion immediately before she is called to testify, which is after Melson's testimony, and during that recess that reconvenes at 2:15. Whatever else is in the record is just confusing.
Well, let me ask you this question, Mr. Powers. What if all the court did was tell the witnesses, step out of the courtroom until you're called to testify? If that's all the court ordered, is there a violation of that order here?
Well, if you look at page 13, let me just go to page 13 of the appendix. When you go to page 13 of the appendix, after the court says to all the witnesses, everybody says, stand up, witnesses, you're going to have to go outside. And then he says, after the first witness is sworn, you're not to discuss this case with any of the witnesses on either side. He's addressing counsel, but everyone in the courtroom hears this. And the reason he addresses counsel specifically is because, obviously, Mr. Toker from the AG's office has never appeared in that courtroom before, and he just wants to make sure he's familiar with the court's familiar with all the lawyers that appear before the court regularly. Just wants to make sure. He knows Mr. Toker knows this.
Well,
but he just wants to make
that
sure.
That says maybe, Mr. Powers, but if the court, if the witnesses were not the ones directed in that regard, it's counsel. In other words, if all the witnesses were told was step out of the courtroom and don't be in the courtroom unless you're actually testifying. If that's the only order that was directed to the witnesses as opposed to counsel, then where is the violation?
If that's the reading that this court gives to the statement from the trial court, I don't think that is an accurate reading.
Well, we don't do a de novo review here.
I know, but I'm just saying reading the words on the face, it says you're not to discuss this with anyone. Now, he does specifically address counsel, but the reason for that is, as I explained, he wants to make sure that Toker understands it. Clearly, Toker didn't understand it because he then asked Melson to do the very thing that he's not allowed to do. But the court has admonished everyone in that courtroom, all the counsel. He says both counsel, and there's three attorneys involved, so clearly we're not cutting
well,
the fine points
on the grammar.
If we were
discussing whether the counsel had violated the court's order, that might be a different issue. As you've conceded, that's not before us. So I'm looking at the court's at the transcript of what the court actually told the witnesses, and it goes simply like this. I'm starting on line 13 from Ms. Stevenson. Motion to separate witnesses, judge. The court, that's granted. All witnesses in the case step outside. All witnesses step outside. And counsel, now directing to counsel, after the first witness is sworn, you are not to discuss this case with any of the witnesses on either side. I think you both understand that. Clearly, that references an order to counsel, not to the witnesses. So I guess to the extent that we're not dealing with any violation of the order by counsel, we're only dealing with a violation of the order by witnesses. If the only order directed to the witness is to step outside, and the trial court has concluded that its order in that respect has not been violated, how do we say it was an error?
The court addresses that again, Your Honor. After the motion to exclude the testimony of Christine Elliott is made by defense counsel, after that motion is made, there's a little colloquy between counsel and the witness as to when you had this conversation. We just reviewed that briefly, and the conversation occurs immediately prior to her testimony, but after Nelson. And then the court goes on, after Toker says what he does, the court goes on and basically says everything is now, this was, he makes the error that it's prior to Melson's testimony, and then he says, I take it that's your objection. And then counsel goes through the objection. What I've stated is, my objection is that these witnesses were conversing together, and the court rules on that objection. The court clearly understanding that the error that counsel is pointing out is that the witnesses have talked together. The court understands that to be the reason and makes the ruling that it makes. That doesn't matter. But it clearly understood the error that we're citing.
I certainly agree with you that the court understood what the lawyers were arguing about at that point. My only concern is whether or not we can say the court erred in not taking some sort of a sanction based on the witnesses doing what they did in this case when the only order directed to the witnesses was to step out of the courtroom, and there's no indication that that order was violated. That's really my concern here.
If that's the concern, if this court determines that there's no factual basis for what I have explained as the admonition of the court, then without conceding myself out of court, I would agree that the logical consequence of that, I'm not unable to see the logic of that. But the point that I make is that's not what the court did. The court admonished everyone in a poor way, I will grant you, but nevertheless, everyone understood, and the court understood that everyone understood, including the witnesses.
Don't get me wrong, Mr. Powers, I'm not approving what the prosecutor in this case did or the attorney general in this case did at all. But, I mean, I think we have to limit ourselves to what, you know, in terms of whether a court order was violated here, we have to look at exactly what the order was and what the conduct is. And, of course, we have to give some deference to the court's interpretation of its own order, it seems to me.
The court's interpretation of its order is that it was, they violated it, but it didn't matter. That's what the court comes
to. They suggest it was sort of a harmless error situation?
That's what the trial court thought. It just doesn't matter. But I think that it does matter because only through Christy Elliott's testimony does the money come out. How much is involved? How the process works? How much everybody gets paid? That all comes out, and this is damning testimony, which excluded...
You're almost out of time, I'm sorry, but now that you're raising, it didn't matter. As I understand the colloquy between the two witnesses, it was only with respect to the ability to identify what the that it was a spreadsheet that showed a remittance history paid to the provider. That was the only thing that was developed in the court as to whether it mattered or not, among other things.
And that spreadsheet is where the money was contained, and that's the issue. Without that testimony, without that evidence, there's no conviction.
But they didn't discuss the content of the spreadsheet itself. The discussion was, do you recognize this? What is this? That's it. That was all. You recognize this as the remittance history.
Well, that's at least what the Attorney General offered occurred between the two witnesses. The Attorney General indicated that the entire purpose of showing them this chirp sheet or asking the witness to talk to the other one about the chart sheet was just to indicate whether she was aware of what it was.
I think
that's what Judge Annunziata
was
saying.
That was what he was trying to say. But what he did was wrong from the beginning, and it caused all the error.
And your argument is that through an agency.
Yeah, he was a puppet.
I understand that your argument is no attorney can violate a court order through the agency of a third party, like a witness.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened, you're arguing.
That's absolutely what happened.
In this case.
And he
calls. Attorney says you can't call. You just can't say, okay, witnesses, you talk and go through this testimony. Of course, it wasn't testimony at that point. I understand the agency argument, but the question is, did it matter? And I guess we'll hear more about
that. And our position is it did matter.
I hear you.
Mr. Powers, we beat you up a little bit there. I'm going to give you 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yeah.
Mr. Schendeville, defend your colleague if you can. Apparently.
I'll do my best. But don't leave my questions before the court. May it please the court, my name is Chris Schendeville on behalf of the Commonwealth this morning. In this appeal, Ms. Young is attempting to rewrite the record in order to create an error that just did not occur. And she's done that in several ways, at least three ways.
Mr. Schendeville, seems to me that the purpose of the motion to separate witnesses is to, in fact, prevent what just happened, which is witnesses conferring, witnesses talking. So how is it not sort of a violation of the spirit of the order?
Your Honor, the spirit of the order and the purpose of excluding witnesses from the courtroom is to prevent witnesses from shaping and changing and modeling their testimony based on what they hear.
And I think that that's what Mr. Powers is arguing by simply discussing the chirp sheet that essentially impacted the witness's testimony prior to going on the stand.
The purpose of excluding witnesses from the courtroom is to prevent witnesses from shaping or changing or modeling their testimony based on what they hear inside the courtroom. So if a witness is inside the courtroom and has not yet testified, hears another witness get up on the stand and testify about what that witness observed, the witness sitting in the courtroom might say, hey, I need to change my testimony based on what I just heard on the stand. You also might want to prevent witnesses from talking to each other outside the courtroom, because if a witness has just finished testifying inside the courtroom and then leaves the courtroom and talks to another witness, that witness who's not yet testified could change their testimony based on what's been said inside the courtroom. Neither of those things happened here.
Mr. Schendeville, to be perfectly frank with you, you're right. You're absolutely right. As Mr. Powers has conceded, it's not before us. But frankly, if the issue before us were whether the Attorney General involved in this case at the trial level violated the court's order, I would take a very dim view of what the conduct here, frankly. I think, as Judge Malvo very politely put it, at the very least, the spirit of the court's order was violated here. But as you and Mr. Powers both correctly point out, that really is not the issue before us. The issue is whether the witnesses in this case, the two witnesses, violated the court's order. And to that extent, I mean, I guess my question simply would be, what our standard of review is and how much deference, if any, we owe the court's interpretation of its own order.
I think this court, certainly, it's an abuse of discretion standard as to whether or not the trial court should allow that witness to testify based on an alleged violation of the court's exclusion order. As to the prosecutor talking to one of the witnesses and whether or not that was a violation of the court's order, of course, as it be conceded, that question is not before the court. But if the question had been argued at trial, the issue had been raised at trial, and if it were before the court now, this court would have the benefit of the trial court having the opportunity to weigh in and to speak to that issue of whether or not the trial court believed that prosecutor talking to witness was a violation of the court's order. The court told the counsel, do not talk to witnesses once they've left the courtroom, except to give them directions and to let them know when they're going to testify. Now, could a prosecutor reasonably have thought, directing these witnesses to just make sure they can identify a certain sheet before even testifying?
Mr. Schendeville, with all due respect, when you're talking about directing the witnesses, you're talking about Mr. X or Ms. Y, please bring these documents in when you come in with you.
Possibly, Your Honor. I don't think
and confer.
I don't think we know that without having the trial court have an opportunity to speak to what it meant when it gave those directions. And because the issue was not raised at trial, we don't know what the trial court intended by those instructions.
I'm going to gently suggest to you, having tried cases for a long time, I'm going to gently suggest to you that the proper mechanism for preparing a witness for trial is to show them the exhibits before they're sequestered, not after in the middle of trial. And if you're preparing your case while it's being tried, that's not an advisable way to go, and that's apparently what occurred.
We would concede that would be the better practice. I think the prosecutor involved realizes that would be the better practice in this case. But because that argument was not raised at the trial level, the trial court did not have the opportunity to speak to what its instructions meant, did not have the opportunity to speak to whether or not that alleged violation should result in witness not being able to testify. So the argument that was made was an argument that because these two witnesses talked to each other during the 2:15 recess, during an earlier recess before either of the witnesses had testified, that second witness should not be allowed to testify. Now, in her brief, on multiple pages, I think I counted 7 separate times, And I've highlighted these on page 21 of my brief. Ms. Young has alleged the trial court specifically told the witnesses not to talk to each other. She does it seven separate times in her brief, and as the court has pointed out, that instruction was never given to the witnesses. The witnesses were merely told to step outside. So she cannot rewrite the record now on appeal to make it appear that violation of that order occurred, and that order to not talk to each other was never given. Under the statute, of course, the trial court is required to exclude the witnesses if that motion is made. And there's a separate rule that gives the court discretion. It says the court may tell the witnesses that they're to remain separated. Of course, the trial court did not do that here, did not have to do that here. And so the trial court certainly did not abuse its discretion by allowing Ms. Elliott to testify. The second way in which Ms. Young attempts to rewrite the record on appeal is by saying that this conversation between the two witnesses occurred after Investigator Melson had testified, but before Christine Elliott had testified. And she, through defense counsel on appeal, has conceded that the Commonwealth disagrees with that contention of hers. I would submit that defense counsel at trial disagreed with that contention that defense counsel is making on appeal. At trial, defense counsel told the court this conversation occurred during the 2:15 recess. That's when I heard them talking to each other.
Before either witness that testified.
Correct, Your Honor. So I think I just heard opposing counsel say that the 2:15 witness was after Investigator Melson had testified. The 2:15 recess occurs at page 85 of the appendix, and Investigator Melson began testifying at page 124 of the appendix.
With respect to the documents that are at issue here in this alleged error, were they identified at any other point in the trial as the remittance sheet?
They were, I believe, in this Investigator Melson's testimony. Yeah. She called them a remittance sheet.
So I guess my question is, if they've already been identified as a remittance sheet, and the witness at issue who had been asked to identify it outside the presence of the courtroom, is there a problem?
I believe they were introduced through Christine Elliott's testimony, so that might be the argument. They're mentioned prior to that, but that would probably be the argument on harmless error that would be made by defense counsel because they were subsequently introduced.
No one's argued harmless error, but I was pretty sure that the record showed that the content of the discussion, whatever occurred between the two witnesses, was addressed in other witnesses, but perhaps not.
That is correct. The content was addressed through Investigator Melson's testimony. The documents.
The fact that it was a remittance sheet, though, was addressed by Elliott.
I believe Investigator Melson also called it a remittance sheet, but the labels applied to the sheets and really actually introducing the sheets into evidence were really unnecessary in order to support the conviction for Ms. Young. All the relevant testimony, the fact that she had made all these fraudulent statements in her timesheets, the fact that Medicaid had been billed for those fraudulent statements, the fact that Ms. Young had been paid based on those fraudulent statements, all that testimony came in before either the investigator, certainly before Christine Elliott testified.
So the fact that the remittance sheet didn't have any real relevance ultimately then?
I think the remittance sheet showed how much money the agency had been paid by Medicaid. But that testimony about that amount had been offered through Investigator Melson.
So it's basically cumulative. It was certainly relevant, but it was also...
Relevant and cumulative. And really just the employees of the agency themselves, through their testimony, they established that Ms. Young had made these fraudulent statements, that no one else had altered these timesheets, that those forms had been used and submitted to Medicaid in order to receive payment from Medicaid, and that Ms. Young was paid based on those timesheets and based on the funds that were obtained through Medicaid. So really, even before Investigator Melson or Christine Elliott testified, the evidence was certainly sufficient to support her conviction. On the sufficiency side, the argument seems to be that, well, because she got on the stand and testified and claimed that she didn't submit any fraudulent entries, and the trial court should have acquitted her. Of course, the trial court is not required to accept the defendant's self-serving testimony, and in fact can conclude that the defendant is testifying in order to conceal her guilt, and that constitutes additional evidence of the defendant's guilt. In this case, the defendant was even asked whether she had any prior convictions for lying, cheating, or stealing. She at first denied that she had any such convictions. When she was confronted with a criminal history report out of New Jersey showing that she did have such prior convictions, she continued to claim that she did not have such convictions, that she was eventually introduced into evidence and proves that not only was her credibility impeached by the prior convictions, it was impeached by her lying about the prior convictions. So certainly on the sufficiency side, the evidence was more than sufficient to support the conviction. And because the assigned error was not error, there were no instructions to give the witness witnesses to not talk to each other. There certainly was no error, and this court should affirm. Unless there are any further questions, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chandable.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Powers, 5 minutes.
Addressing once again the timing, and I think this is the critical issue. The 215 number does appear at page 85 in the record. I acknowledge that in the appellant's brief before this court. And as what the record says as to when Melson is called to testify, I think it's page 124, and then later Ms. Elliott at 147. That being the sequence that the record shows. When you look over to page 144, this is after another break is taken. And at this point, Ms. Stevenson, who is defense counsel, says, I have an objection to this witness because I've just now seen them talking. And we go on, we have this conversation that is the conversation about the two women talking about the spreadsheet. At that point, Ms. Stevenson says, I saw them in the witness room going through the binder before we came back from the 2:15 break. We have immediately above that on this same page of the transcript taken a brief break. The timing, and I know this court has read more transcripts than I, and is probably dizzy from reading transcripts. However, when I read this transcript, the timing cannot work out so that you have a break at 2:15 and then you have all this conversation, all this testimony, and then another break that also occurs at 2:15. It can only be one of the 2:15s. It's either the 2:15 is right, or it's error at the start, or it's here. The record says what it says, and I can tell you what my theory is about it, that it's a typographical error. It should have been 12:15 or 1:15 or 11:15. I can do that, but that's not the point. The point is, the record is not clear, but what is clear is Ms. Elliott's testimony when she says, I testified, and we came back at the 2:15, at 2:15 when we came back, and that was, now I'm testifying. She has already testified. We have talked, and now I'm testifying. It doesn't matter exactly when those events occurred, at 2:15, 11:15. The sequencing is, Ms. Melson testifies, they have a conversation, and then Ms. Elliott testifies. And that's what we consider as the error.
Mr. Powers, did you want to comment on Mr. Chandable's argument with respect to the spreadsheet here being, or the remittance, I should say, the remittance sheet being admitted as being basically cumulative evidence that, although he didn't expressly say this, the suggestion or the implication was that it's therefore harmless error if it's error at all?
As to that, Your Honor, the evidence that the spreadsheet reveals, all these numbers and dates, and it's not a complicated document, but it is an overwhelming document when you just look at it and you see just lots of numbers, and you get to the ultimate number of 1933 and 73 cents.
But if all of that was testified to by other witnesses,
but the point is that is only going to be testified to by the other witnesses by being able to reference this. These are numbers that you're not going to be able to pull out of your head just because I review. This is what I do all day long. I review Medicaid fraud. I review Medicaid applications for payment. I look at all these and I compare this spreadsheet to this invoice, to this record. I look at all the electronic stuff. There's no way that either Ms. Elliott or Ms. Melson can remember those numbers without reference to some document, and that's permissible. Once that document comes in, then you can kind of refer to it, and while we don't have an issue here on recollection of memory or refreshment or anything like that, without the document having been looked at by Ms. Elliott prior to her testimony, it's impossible to believe she would have remembered those numbers from over a year ago. That just belies credulity. So it seems to me that that is important, and while it may have ultimately been cumulative, when the oral testimony is, this is the number, 4,600 and change, or 1,900 and change is the actual loss. Maybe that's true that the document itself, which has those same numbers, is cumulative. The oral testimony would never have occurred if it hadn't been for the document that she reviewed prior to her testimony.
You're saying the record establishes that she actually reviewed it with respect to content, not is showing her the document.
I have no idea what she reviewed it.
Okay, I don't either, but that's what you're arguing. You're arguing that she actually studied it in some depth so that she could testify to it with more refreshed knowledge, et cetera. But I don't see that in the record.
She clearly recognized it as the damning document. This is the silver bullet.
She recognized it as what they called the remittance sheet, what had actually been paid to Medicare. But just recognizing that is something that was evident in other evidence, in fact, the document itself.
But the numbers were never in evidence.
Well, the document, I agree.
And that's the point.
Right.
She recognizes this is the culmination.
There was testimony about the numbers.
This is the culmination.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Powers. We'll come down to Greek Council and take up the last case of the day, Mitch versus Council.